Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Kama sakom hi kama dayado kama yoni kama pati savano yanka mankavisami kalyanam wa papakang wa tassa dayado bhavisami ti. Which that small verse after Namo Tassa is one of those reflections which we do. That I am born of my karma, heir to my karma. Imagine that I am kamasakomi. What do they usually say? I am made of my karma, owner of my karma. So owner of my karma, they usually translate it as owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I do, wholesome or unwholesome, of that I shall be the heir. One of those reflections for one who's gone forth. And a couple of people have been talking to me about karma in the last week, and I want to sort of talk about that and how that fits into our practice, not just the ordinary ways of dealing with the law of karma. But as many people said to me, a couple of people, that the whole purpose of this life of being a monk, being a novice, a nun, anagarika, whatever you are, the whole purpose of life is to try and end samsara. And one way of looking at that is trying to end karma, one of the great causes of rebirth, and trying to overcome the karma, the bad karma, and even the good karma as well, trying to transcend it. Because when you look at what that statement actually says, that, you know, I'm born of my karma, I'm heir to my karma, you know, whatever karma I've done, good or bad, I'm going to cop that in the future. I'm going to receive that. That's really frightening. Because I don't know about you, but in my life is some bad karma I've done, some good karma I've done. There's a few of those bad deeds I haven't been paid for yet. So you think, what's going to happen? That's only in this life. What about in previous lives? And sometimes when the Buddha says about all the lives you've lived, you know, just like if you heap up the bones from your many, many lives, they're more than on the great mountains of the Himalayas. You've cried more tears than there are waters in the great ocean. So many lives and so much karma. Remember the way that karma works. You do a good deed, you get it rewarded, not just once, but many, 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 many times. You do a sort of a bad deed, and that gets rewarded many, 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 many times. In other words, painful results, not just once, but many, many times. It's just like planting a seed. A mango seed gives you thousands of mangoes. And that's very similar to the law of karma. So sometimes you think, all the bad karma I've done over many lifetimes, that's pretty heavy stuff. So how can you overcome that? How can you transcend it? How can there be a way of ending this being caught up as the heir to your karma? Being made of your karma, as karma being the womb out of which you are born. How can we put an end to this? How can we stop karma? And it's a very great question, because in the time of the Buddha, many people tried to exhaust karma by doing ascetic practices, thinking, okay, I've done some bad karma, let's go and torture myself and let's wear it all out. And obviously that does not work. You can't exhaust karma, there's just too much of it. Instead of exhausting, we tend to transcend it. When you actually understand how karma works, you know, sometimes you can see that some of these places where people get reborn, such as in the Deva realms, or in the Jhana realms, or even in the hell realms, that people have what they call manomayakaya, mind-made bodies. In the Deva realms, mind-made bodies. In the Jhana realms, it's a perception-made bodies. It's very interesting just the way that the Buddha actually described these things. The mind makes the body. What type of mind makes a body which can live in a hell realm? In other words, you make the body according to how you feel you should be punished. And it was a great insight to understand that the only reason why people are caught up, you know, in this web of karma, and why they have to keep receiving the fruits of the karma again and again and again, is mostly because they think they deserve to have that karma. There's a great saying of the Buddha that whenever there's a self, there are things belonging to a self. Where there's no things which belong to you, there's no self. Where there's no self, there's no things which belong to you. So if there is no self, actually how can there be an owning of this karma? Which gives the clue to how we do transcend karma, how we move beyond it so we don't have to keep being reborn again. The way to overcome that is very much the realization, the penetration to the truth of what the Buddha meant by anatta, or no self. Another way of putting that no self idea is to have no owner. There's no owner inside who possesses these things. That's a very hard thing for us to see, because we are brought up conditioned, not just in this lifetime, but many lifetimes, of being like possessors. Possessors of our culture, possessors of our wisdom, possessors of our ideas and views, possessors even of our karma. And it's a strange thing just how people take the karma which they've made and own it, and thereby make their pleasure and pain and also their future. And a wonderful realization for anyone who's seen through anatta is you don't need to do that. All the karma which you have made is inexhaustible. And you can't just somehow overcome the bad karma by making heaps and heaps of good karma. Yeah, the Buddha said you can dilute the bad karma with making good karma, but you can't get rid of it. Even they say the spoonful of salt put in the great lake of water, you can hardly taste the salt. But a spoonful of plutonium put in a great lake and it poisons everything. There are some karmas which are so heavy will kill you because it's just so potent. So sometimes you just can't get rid of the bad karma just by diluting. There must be some sort of other way. And that's the way out of samsara, to understand first of all just the heaviness of karma and to find out the only way to get rid of that karma is to see thoroughly the fact there's no owner inside, there's no possessor, there's no person inside who should take responsibility for the good and bad karma which you have made. And I say that very carefully, because taking responsibility is sometimes taking responsibility for things which are none of our business. You see that in the world, that people tend to take responsibility and try and exert their influence and power on things which are none of their business. You know, just committees, organizations, councils, who tend to try and increase their area of influence and have more and more things to wield power over. This is the nature of ourself. We get born, we own nothing, and we tend to collect things over our life. And of those things which we collect, we exert power over. That's why we say we own these things. That idea which the Buddha said, that wherever there's a self, there's things which belong to you. Where there's things which belong to you, there you'll find a self. It's a great way of understanding what this self truly means. It's that which tends to own and possess. And when it owns and possesses, then it wants to control. From a sense of self, we get the sense of craving and attachment. They're sort of intricately linked, you can't separate them. The only way to overcome that craving and that sense of ownership is to see through this illusion of a me who's running the show. As long as there is an illusion there, a delusion of me, a delusion of self, then you will be fully open to the karma of your past. You will think that you own that karma. You will think that you deserve to reap the rewards of those things you did a long time ago, or even yesterday or last week. The way out is to see through non-self. And the motivation to see through that non-self is actually to see just the pain of so much karma, so much unfinished business. It's like you have an incredible amount of papers on your desk. You have so many letters to write, so many things to fix up, so many dishes to wash, so many paths to sweep. It's endless, this law of karma, and the amount of work which it's got you to do. And sometimes we look at just how hard we work. I'm not just meaning just how hard you work at sweeping or cleaning the toilets. I mean, how hard you work in life. And sometimes people get tired. I don't mean physically tired, but mentally tired of the striving of samsara. It's very hard to run a monastery or a nun's monastery or a committee. It's hard enough to run your own body, let alone other people's. And so you understand just how painful and how much of a struggle this life is. And for those of you here in Australia, in a Buddhist monastery, this is as good as it gets. This is the peak. This is, of all the lives, this is one of the top. And if this sucks, imagine what it must be like outside. Understanding this gives you the incentive to put an end to this karma. And you don't put an end to karma by making more karma, even more good karma. So if you go out there trying to sort of do great deeds in this world, trying to sort of save the suffering of this world, setting up a charity, going out to sort of feed the poor, you know, looking after hospices, becoming a doctor and saving the lives of people who would die without you. Whatever you tend to do in this world, just making good karma is not going to really help the problem. In a simile which I gave some years ago of the prison cell, it's like a person in a prison and you get other people in there. Instead of actually busting them out of the jail cell and getting them out into freedom, you just tend to decorate their prison cell, you know, to paint it, to make it a tiny bit more comfortable. That's actually what it's like helping in the world. It's just like decorating and upgrading the prison cells, but it's not getting out of prison. It's not solving the root problem. However, when we understand just the fear which is inherent in a big understanding of the law of karma, it really gives us an incentive to try and do something important to transcend this karma. One of the scariest, or probably actually the most scariest teaching of the Buddha which I ever read in the suttas was a simile of the stick. And the Buddha said when you throw a stick up in the air, it can land on either end. Even if one end is heavy and the other end is light, still it can land on the light end. He said that's just with the karma which we've done. We've done lots of good karma, lots of bad karma. I don't know which end is the heaviest, but even if the good karma end is the heaviest, you've done heaps and heaps and heaps of good karma, still there's always a bit of bad karma there. There's another end of a stick. And sometimes the stick lands on the light side, not the heavy side. Sometimes you've done heaps and heaps of good karma, but just a tiny bit of bad karma is enough to give you a terrible rebirth. And that really scared me, because I always thought at the beginning, as long as I make lots of good karma, as long as I'm kind and sacrifice myself for others, do people's visas, clean up the monastery, make lots of good karma, care for monks who are sick, and do all of this really kind work, I thought, well, that's all I need to do, just be a really good monk. Just making good karma wasn't enough. When I read that, I thought, my goodness, I still might have some bad karma, and that might be what fruits in the next life. And that scared me, because I realized just making good karma is not enough. It has to be something more. It's actually seeing the problem, seeing the danger, or as one monk said today, seeing the cost of karma. Yeah, you make some good karma, but there's still a cost to it. Making bad karma is even more costly to you. You have to pay for something. However, we're here to try and find some freedom from that. And to find that freedom from the law of karma is to understand how karma works. The Buddha made it very clear when he said that karma is intention. Chedanahang karmang vadami, said the Buddha. When he made that connection between karma and will, or choice, or doing, you can see that whenever you do anything, you are making some karma. Whenever you act, you're making karma. Whenever you speak, you make karma. Even when you think, you're making mental karma. Any intended action is karma. When we make those intentions, there is some results afterwards. But it's not just the results, it's how come those results affect us? You don't need to be a great expert on psychology and the nature of the brain and your mind to realize that we allow those things to affect us. We actually pick up the results of our karma. And that can work two ways. First of all, if you've done some bad stuff, why is it we can't just forgive and just let it go? That's something which has always fascinated me for so many years. Why is it when someone has done something bad and mean, they said something they shouldn't have said, why don't they just say, I'm sorry, and just let it go and move on? Why is it when someone has said something bad to you, you can't just let it go and move on? It's really a strange thing that human beings, they collect and collect and collect. And as that simile, which I will not repeat with the two chicken farmers, we usually end up collecting the bad stuff from what other people do to us. So, what do we collect of our own karma? In the same way that we tend to collect the unpleasant experiences which other people do to us, we also tend to collect the bad karma which we do. Much more so than the good karma which we do. And because we collect much of the bad karma of our past, it's the most stupidest thing to do. We're actually looking for suffering. We gather suffering. We begin to own suffering. And of course that's why we suffer. We're gathering the bad karma from the past, the akusala stuff. It's amazing how many people just focus and remember and dwell in the bad karma. They're very much like that worm in the pile of dung who will not come out of that dung, even though other people try and pull them out. Why do you do that? Of course, it's because that people identify with being the suffering being. They make the self, that's who they think they are, they're the one who suffers. That's their ego, that's their identity, that's their personality. And so once you build a personality like that, the sufferer, of course you'll start to pick up the bad stuff from the past. That is not the way to any sort of freedom. I remember going to give a speech at a grief and loss conference many, many years ago. And you all know that in Buddhism, the Dharma, you just read the suttas, read the Petawattu. There's some great stories in the Petawattu about how Buddhists deal with death. I remember this great sort of story there about, I think it was a son who died of snake bite, or was a father died of snake bite. And all their family, they weren't crying there. They said, well, we didn't invite... No, it was a son. He said, we didn't invite him into this life. He came unbidden, and he went without taking leave. It's a beautiful little saying there. Children come into your life. You don't know where they come from. When they leave, you don't know where they go to. They're just passing through. It's wonderful to think like that. Your father, your mother. They're seeing people just passing through your life. Your children, your brother and sister, you didn't invite them in. You didn't give them permission to go. They just come and go in spite of you. So why cry? to see that the lack of grief sort of in Buddhist people at the time of death of their loved ones or their relations, I really shouldn't call it loved ones, was quite amazing to see. And I saw that in practice over many years in Thailand. 9 years I was at Wat Nanachat and other monasteries in that area. I think it was only once in those 9 years, there's so many funeral services, only once I saw maybe one or two tears, and that was by a young lady, she's probably influenced by the TV. But grief wasn't there. When I went to this grief and loss conference, then I made the point that grief is a culturally added phenomena onto loss. Now, it's not natural. If it was natural in the sense of has to be there with all cultures, you'd see it in Thailand. I never saw it there with all those years. And understanding it's something added was quite shocking for many people, because it was an assumption that when someone dies you had to get grief. But the interesting thing was, there was a lady who came up afterwards. She'd gone to every grief and loss conference for the last 10 or 15 years. She was a professional griever, and she blasted me. She said, "What right have you to tell me that I shouldn't grieve?" And you can see that that was herself. She was the griever. That was who she was. And I was actually destroying her sense of self. And when I saw how people can attach to the bad karma of their past, and they cruelly torture their own lives, it's really something to see how people create their own hell and how they get reborn in those lower realms. And they don't have to. They carry with them the bad karma. So the very, very least, now we should have the insight, if not the insight, the faith from the word of the Buddha and the teaching of the great monks and nuns to let go of the bad karma of the past, our own and others as well. It doesn't matter who said what to you or what they did. That's their business, nothing to do with you. What I've said and done which was stupid, which was bad, that is my... No, it's not. It's not my business either. I let that one go too. Because of non-self, I can let that go too. Why should I seek it out to punish myself? A lot of times I sometimes wonder, how does actually karma ripen sometimes? A lot of times karma ripens because you seek out that particular karma. Sometimes it's like a resonance. Something happens today, and it sort of jogs your memory. I always think that there's a lot to do with the ripening of karma and the process of memory. Why is it one can remember a long time ago? Why is it through meditation you can remember previous lives? That connection there is how karma could actually come through the past into the present. The memory, the dwelling on the past, the seeking out of the past. And that's how karma can work. You all know in the Bhaddhekarata suttas, you know, those famous suttas on one fortunate night, I think, is the accepted translation now, if I'm not wrong. In those beautiful poems, it tells you to just let go of the past and don't worry about the future. If you really do let go of the past and don't even think about the past and don't dwell upon the past, what other people did or what you did, you actually become almost immune from the karma of the past. Not totally immune, but so much of it, it disappears. And you can do that with a little bit of, not so much practice, a bit of faith and insight. The biggest insight is that it's allowable, it can be done, and it's a positive thing to do. You're not being irresponsible by letting go of that bad karma of the past. At the very, very least, you should pick up the good karma of the past, as I've been teaching you for a long time. Don't think about the rotten things which someone has said to you. Think of all the kind things they've said to you. Don't think of the bad parts of their character. Look at the noble parts of their character. It makes life much happier. And also, what you find out in practice, when you look at the nobility and the kindness and goodness in another person, that's what they tend to show you. That's what grows. Whatever you focus on, you're encouraging in that other person. So just out of kindness to other people, to try and help them along the path, look at their good parts. The same with yourself. Look at your good parts, your good qualities, your nobility. Otherwise you get so depressed you can't stand yourself. And of course, this is an important part if you want to motivate yourself to get into some nice deep meditation. To remember your good qualities, to reflect upon your sila, reflect upon your generosity. This is those 40 gamatanas, the two of them, sila anusati, chaga anusati. This is what we're supposed to do according to the Buddha's teachings, to reflect upon these things, to reflect upon our goodness. I don't know anywhere that the Buddha said, you know, you should do the akusala anusati. Or the papanusati, you know, your bad karma, to keep reflecting upon those. He said the chaganusati and the silanusati, the good parts which you have done. Because when you at least reflect upon that, your good karma, it's as if you bring up the fruits of the past good karma. And you, oh, I mean, you're just amazing people who actually come and listen to a Dharma talk in a Buddhist monastery that you'd be ordained. As nuns, as novices, monks, even ordained as anagarikas, even the cat has amazing good karma by being born in this monastery. So the fact you're here, you've got amazing good karma. Make use of that. You've done a lot of good work and a lot of kindness. So what we do, we reflect upon that. Reflect upon the goodness we've done today. We've cleaned the toilets. You know, we've sort of looked after Ajahn Kampong and given him a cup of ginger tea. Whatever it is you've done, that is good karma. You know it's good karma. So you reflect upon that. And when you reflect upon that and you remember it, you get inspiration. You get happiness. You can dwell upon that, draw upon that. But that gives you a very big boost for any meditation practice you want to do. For those of you who have been listening to me for years, that is one of my important practices. Every time I get tired and worn out because of all the stuff I have to do, and I want to meditate, I just reflect on all the good karma I've done that day. I never think of the bad karma I've done. I think of all the good karma. I dwell upon that. I focus on that, just like you watch the breath going in, going out, going in, going out, and you don't lose focus on the breath for many, many minutes. I focus on the good karma I've done for many, many minutes continually. Until you start getting huge amounts of energy coming up, sometimes even tears coming down your face. You get the joy, inspiration. And as you all know, from joy and inspiration, you get this pramudha, this gladness of the mind, and from gladness of the mind, you get pity. And from pity, you get the tranquility of the body. From tranquility of the body, you get the sukha, the happiness. From happiness, you get the stillness of samadhi. And from the stillness of samadhi, you see things as they really are. You become an arya. All because you've developed the joy from remembering your past good karma. So that's an amazing thing to do. If you're going to be looking at karma, forget, dump the bad karma. Don't really think about that. But look at the good karma. Do that in yourself. And then you can do that in other people. Which means you respect other people so much. You don't get into all this anger and negativity towards one another. You see the beautiful good karma in the people you live with. And how wonderful it is to have such noble companions in the holy life. Such high-minded friends. You know, it's wonderful to be valued in a community. You know that other people in this community really think highly of you. And that can happen if we develop that mind which lets go of the bad karma and couldn't have anything, focus on the good karma of the past. And we focus on that good karma of the past because that can bring us to a state of inspiration to create happiness which gives us a stillness of samadhi. One of the teachings I've been pushing ever since I took over as abbot here, even beforehand, the happiness is an important part of the path. You can't get into deep meditation without happiness, without joy, without inspiration. Sukhino chittang samadhi yati, that happiness is a cause of stillness. So we try and get people to create as much stillness as possible by creating the joy, by creating some good karma and making use of the good karma and dumping the bad karma. You do that at first of all. Until you get to see, you know, this being we take to be us. And especially by developing that stillness, you've all heard me say this so many times, you're suppressing the doer. You're suppressing Chaitanya. You're suppressing Sankara. You know that one of the descriptions of enlightenment is Sabba Sankara Samatha. To calming, to quelling, to tranquilizing all the sankharas. By doing this meditation practice, you're not suppressing all of the sankharas yet, but you're suppressing a lot of them. One of the things you're suppressing this controller, this doer, this will, which is the most important of the sankharas. When you let go of doing, you find out what it means not to be making any karma whatsoever. Because karma comes from will. So when you stop willing, you stop making karma. You poise. And because you dwell in the present moment, you're immune from the karma from the past, both good and bad. You use a bit of past good karma to get you going. And then you drop all the karma from the past. In the present moment, if you really are in the present moment, your connection to the past, to a place where karma can get you, is gone. Especially when you get into those jhanas, they say that those are places where Mara can't find you, where Mara is blindfolded. The karma, the doer, just can't get to you anymore. You're free from karma for a while. That's why it's a beautiful state to know. It gives you an idea how karma can be transcended. It also gives you an idea of what this controller, what this doer actually is. Just experiences of deep meditation when everything stops, you're just so calm and so peaceful, you aren't making any karma, you're not trying to get into jhanas, you're not trying anything, you're not making karma. You're stopping. Understanding that gives you a great clue of how to transcend karma and also what karma really is. All comes from this sense of self doing things, picking up the past, reacting to it and doing something else. Going on and on and on, which is what samsara is, the wheel which never stops rolling. This is how you get off the wheel, by stopping this karmic function of will, doing, controlling, managing, making things happen. So if the whole path of Nibbana is to quell not just one sankhara but all the sankharas, you can see that this is an important part of that path. To learn at least how to calm, what you might call the most important part, to calm the will down, so you're not making any karma at all in the deep meditations. You're just absolutely still, not moving, so no karma. When you understand that, you also understand just why the heck you willed in the first place. Why do you do so much? It's not to try and get something, or it's not because out of compassion. Most of the time people will, just because that's what they have to do to exist. That confirms, affirms their sense of self. Always see that very clearly, that when there's a self, they have to do things. The bigger the self, the more they have to do. The bigger the ego, the more they have to control. That's why big egos like to run the whole world. At least us, our egos, we want to run ourselves. We want to run our meditation, we want to control our hearts, we want to control our mind. It's all coming from a sense of self. Where there's a sense of self is that which you think belongs to you, and that's what you want to control. Now look at it. What did the Buddha say? Now what do you own? And the Buddha said you own absolutely nothing. You have no possessions. Your bowl belongs to the Buddha. Your robe you have on loan from the Buddha. I say, until you're an arahat, you're not an owner of the requisites. That's what the Buddha said. So you're just on loan. You don't own your body. It belongs to nature. Those of you who are old realize that very clearly. You don't own your mind. Those of you who've been trying desperately to get to meditate and haven't been able to succeed yet, you know why you can't meditate? It should be pretty obvious. You don't own your mind. You can't control it. If you could control the mind, if you really could control it, you should have figured out by now how to get into jhana whenever you want. You can't control these things. They don't belong to you. They're none of your business. So for heaven's sake, just leave them alone. Let them go completely. Some people say, if you let go, the mind will just go off into lust or go off into fantasies or go in dreaming. That doesn't happen. If you truly let go 100%, you just get still. It's because you don't let go. That is why you get sleepy, because you don't let go fully. That's why you get into fantasies or dreams. It's because you try to get involved, to try and find pleasure ever here, ever there. That's why things don't get still. You're still involved. I was saying also to someone in the interviews the last fortnight, this part of meditation, as you go deeper into the stillnesses of meditation, that's where you see how you get involved. That's how you see places where you just cannot let go. And the obstacles to enlightenment, it's not just the pretty girls or the anger. The coarse stuff is not really the problem. The real problem is these fine attachments you get, which stops you getting into nimittas and jhanas. This last little piece of the dua, always wanting to control, this last most subtle part of your idea of self, that's what stops you. That's why when we get to the deeper meditation, if you get stuck, great. This is where the work is. In those places, as you meditate and try and go deeper, the places which stop you. Why? Where are you getting involved there? Where are you making business here? Where are you making karma? You're making karma there somewhere. That's why you can't stop the karma and become absolutely still. When you see those places, you get these incredible, fascinating, powerful, deep insights. It's as if like Mara is stopping you, and you see, I know you, Mara. Mara just slinks off. You don't have to control, you don't have to kill Mara or beat Mara, you just have to know Mara. And Mara goes, and then you go to the next stage of meditation, deeper. Simply because you've seen where you're being controlling. You get to an idea of this dua, the karma. The karmic force, what it does and why it does it. It's because you think you have a self, that's why you make karma. And because you think you have a self, that's why you receive karma. Receive vipaka of karma, I should say. So it's all caught up, you know, with the delusion of a self. So to overcome that delusion, you have the delusion of self, be honest. At least look at the good karma of the past. Forget the bad karma of the past. Forgive it, let it go, move on. Yours and other people's bad karma. Pick up your good karma of the past, yours and other people. That motivates you into enough to get into deep meditation, to become that still. You can see through this illusion of a self. There is no one there. This will is completely conditioned. There's not a you inside doing this. Being this, that is very, very clear from the Buddha's teachings. None of these things is a self, a controller. When you actually see that, and come out afterwards, if you really see it 100%, you, my friend, are a stream winner. An Aryan. And that is why a person who is a stream winner, an Aryan, will no longer be subject to the karma which sends you into the lower realms. That was always a really fascinating part of the Dhamma for me. Why is it that a stream winner, an Aryan, can never get reborn in the hell realms, or as an animal, or as a ghost? Why not? And I know it had to be something to do with the fact that the stream winner had actually seen non-self and realized there was no one in there. It's obvious when you can get your head around, if you're not a stream winner, imagine what it's like to be a stream winner. That, you know, this, you know that there's no self in there. And that guilt, grief, the responsibility for the past is seen through. You understand how karma works and how a lot of times, because of our doer, we create. So that link with the past, bring up the bad karma usually, and create a lot of suffering for ourselves and send ourselves down to the hell realms. Is there hell realms? Yeah, there are. How are they? You make your hell realms, you design them yourself. And how long do you stay down there? As long as you think you deserve. It's amazing just when you understand the psychology of the mind because you've meditated deeply. All these superficial things which psychologists say, you understand deeper how they work. Why is it the person punishes themselves from the past? Why is it they have pain from the past? Why is it that they are bound to their past? Only because the sense of self. They think they have to do that, and that's so deeply ingrained into some people, they just find it very difficult to let it go. How do they let it go? They don't let it go by keeping on dwelling on the past. That just makes things worse. By dwelling on the pain of the past. Dwell upon some pleasure of the past, some good of the past. Dwell on the positive, the wholesome. Because that inspires, frees, just enough, long enough, for you to get into a deep meditation and see non-self. Remember, you can't see non-self by thinking about it. You have to get into the jhanas to see non-self. You have to sort of, the whole simile of the tadpole has to leave the lake and become a frog before it can understand what water is. No way can you understand what will is when his will is always there for you. No more than a fish can understand what water is. When you get in these jhanas, will is stopped. You understand what this doer actually is. Understand how it is a process. It's not a thing, not a me, not a mind, not a being, not a self, not an Ajahn Brahm, not an Ajahn Brahmani, Apichata, no one. It's just a process. Because it's a process, it can be let go of. It can cease. It can stop. Because it's a process, the bad karma from the past can cease. If there was a being in there, you will never be able to let it go, because that will be part of you. So we can let go of past bad karma. An Angulimala, serial killer, can be an arahat, can let it all go. It's amazing what can happen. The power of those teachings is immense. That's how we overcome the karma from the past. And as we learn more and more to overcome the karma from the past, by being a stream winner. If you're not even a stream winner, when you die, how on earth are you going to let go of that karma from the past? When you die, you're going to think, what the hell have I done in the past life? And usually, if you're someone who's had a negative upbringing from fear and guilt, you're going to have a terrible future life. At least you've had a positive upbringing, and you had people talking to you about looking at the 998 good bricks in the wall. You've had people talking to you about letting go of the pain of the past and not collecting the ship but collecting the eggs. At least you've had that much, you've got a good chance of getting a heavenly rebirth or a good rebirth. Because when you die, and you've still got a sense of self, it's all about what you think you own, what you think you deserve. All of that conditioning from your life is going to determine which part of karma you're going to bring up. So even if the heavy end of the stick, the good karma, is the good karma, still you actually choose for the lighter end of the stick, the bad karma, to come to fruition. It's not just chance, you choose to do that. It's incredible just how stupidity causes so much pain. and so much negative rebirths. At least that much, let go of the pain of the past. At least carry the good stuff of the past. At least that will make it more likely that the good karma will fall to the ground. And even if you've got a stick which is heavily weighted with bad karma, even just a little bit of positive psychology, just the thinking of the good karma when you die, will give you a good rebirth. That's why I sometimes have monks around the last few moments before people die, reminding them of their good karma, reminding them of their generosity, reminding them of inspiring teachings or whatever, just to get their mind having a little bit of good karma, because that's what they will choose then to mature at the time of their death. But anyway, what are you going to choose at the time of your death? If you've got like bad thoughts because you're having an argument with somebody, or you're down on yourself because you never got up early this morning or whatever, and you happen to die just right now, you have a heart attack, where are you going to get reborn? And people do die at any moment. Look at, you know, we all know, I just actually brought her ashes into the back room this afternoon, Shirley Jackson. Brady, you've known Shirley, Cherry's mother, just serving dinner to her husband, and just heart stopped, just fell down and died right there. Completely unexpected, as it were. Although, we always expect people to die at any time, but for most people that was an unexpected death. And that happens, it might happen to you, any time, before, you know, you even get back to your hut tonight. So, please do not entertain sort of bad thoughts. If you have had a bad thought or bad speech or bad action, drop it now. If you carry it with you, that's dangerous. You're playing with fire. You might get a bad rebirth because you are dwelling on the bad karma. At the very least, dwell on the good karma. Inspire yourself. And see if you can get to this point you don't dwell on any karma at all. You can't just do this by deciding on it, by thinking about it, or just playing around. This has to come from the realization of non-self. Not just an intellectual realization. A deep, thorough, experiential realization. There's no one in here. Therefore, I don't own anything. Therefore, you can let go of the karma of the past. It's a great insight to know you can do that, can be done. Why not? Otherwise, will there be ever freedom from karma? When you know you can let go of the karma from the past, it also knows you can let go of the karma of the present as well. You can let go of doing things. You don't have to keep being involved in the world. You don't have to keep being involved in your body. You don't have to keep hearing and feeling. That's another thing. Why is it we can't let go of feeling and we can't let go of sound? It's amazing just what we mean by attachment. The reason why when people are meditating they can't let go of sound is again because they think they own that sound. It's their business. It's their responsibility to listen. The reason why we can't let go of our body's aches and pains is because we think we own our body. It's our responsibility. That's the area where I control, so I better look after it. It's amazing when you really know deep down, thoroughly, experientially, you don't own the sound, you don't own the physical feelings of the body, you don't own sight, smells and touches. If you can just let them go, you can drop them. What you don't own is easy to drop. What you do own is very hard to give away. So what you can't let go of, it's not because of lack of trying, it's because of wrong ideas. You drop things through wisdom power, seeing that these aren't your business. Drop them. What another person says and does is not your business. Forget about them. They call you a bloody idiot. That's not my business. You say whatever you like. But I am not going to worry about your karma. So that way, you can drop things. If someone says, you're the number one teacher, actually, because that's written on a towel, which somebody found, was one of the birthday gifts I just gave to the storeroom. So they've got Ajahn Brahm, number one teacher. So I've kept that one. Why not keep that? Because it inspires you and gives you a lot of happiness. Thank you very much. If they put on the towel, Ajahn Brahm, you suck big time, then I'll give that up to the stores. So this way you're inspiring yourself. You're keeping a good karma, at least, if you're going to keep anything. But you don't really keep that. I don't believe that. So you can drop everything. You don't own anything at all. When you learn how to drop the results of the past karma, you can also drop making good karma as well. In other words, you can let go. I think actually it's somewhere the Buddha said that seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is all karma. It's a wonderful little saying, it's all karma. Because that you've heard before, seen before, you actually develop the sense basis. Because you develop the sense basis, here they are again. It's amazing when you can drop these things. When you drop these things, you're not developing the sense basis, either in this life or the next life. And when you don't develop these things, the sense basis tend to fade away. Just like a flower not being watered, it just withers. Because you don't develop the sense basis by listening to music or seeing beautiful things or by having beautiful touches, smells and tastes, they fade away. They're not a problem for you anymore. That's why people indulge in the world. They indulge in watching movies, in sex, in great flavored foods or whatever. It actually increases the intensity of the sensory experience. It means it's just harder for those senses to fade away. It becomes almost impossible for them to get into deep meditation where the senses completely disappear. They really get sort of caught up. But when we learn how to calm down those senses, to let them go because they don't belong to us, the more we tend to do that, the easier it becomes. Because of sense restraint, the association we have, the ownership which we have, or we feel we have with our senses, tends to diminish. And the less we think we own our senses, the less we think we can control what the senses experience, the easier it is to let them go, until they completely disappear. We realize we don't own these things at all. They're nothing to do with us. They're just actually basically an irritation to see, to hear, to smell, to taste. It's an irritation. Remember Ajahn Jayasaro said once, wouldn't it be great if instead of having to have a food, you just get a pill. One pill with all the vitamins and proteins and everything else we need for the day. We just give every monk and nun a pill in the morning. And they can meditate by themselves all day. Even when we have the pills, we can give people a blessing for the pill they gave us today and have done with it. And just go back to our rooms. We don't even need a bowl. Just put the pill in our mouth. Chew it and just be done with it. A lot of people wouldn't like that because they're just caught up with the sense pleasures. However, when we learn how to calm us, or rather let go of our sense of ownership, things become very calm, we become very peaceful, we start to disappear. The more we disappear, as it were, the karma from the past has got less of a target to hit us. When we got ourself, the karma from the past has got this huge target and we can always be hit by the arrows, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. That's from Hamlet. And we get hit by these things. But where we start to disappear, nothing can hit us anymore. We get smaller targets as our sense of self and identity disappears. When our sense of self and identity completely disappears, we're not a target at all. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, they just can't find us. Therefore they just go straight past, and nothing sticks. No karma from the past, good or bad, sticks to us. At last, we are free. That's all because of non-self. And the way I otherwise say the non-self, we realize we don't have to pick up the karma of the past. Not necessary, we don't own it, none of our business. And therefore, most of it doesn't attach to us. The only karma which still attaches to us is the karma of the of the body. There it is, the body from the past, male, female, whatever. That's the sort of karma you just have to endure for the rest of your life. But the other karma, all gone. We can put an end to karma. And it's also, once we put an end to karma, we don't make any more karma. We don't make any more karma by not doing things. By not having a sense of self, which is always controlling the world, making it happen, helping this and doing that. Even the idea of a bodhisattva. If you understand what sort of non-self is, the whole idea of a bodhisattva is absolutely stupid, ridiculous. So it's an idea from people who didn't understand or hadn't realized the core teaching of the Buddha of non-self. Very sort of arrogance of thinking you're going to help all other beings. That's completely conceited. That you are doing this. It's another doing, a big doing. And people think it's the most noble of doings. But all doings suck. All doings just create more samsara. With the what looks like the greatest of motives, but it's unwise and creates more problems. The bodhisattva is the ultimate do-gooder who creates more problems. But instead of that, we just learn how to completely abandon all doing, to disappear, to vanish. Not to become the great saviour of the world. That's what Mara tried to tempt the Buddha into doing, to be the great bodhisattva. But Buddha knew more than that. He said, no, teach the Dharma and then I'm out of here. Which is what he did. So understanding just what the sense of self is, there's this great illusion to think you're in control. If you just imagine what it's like not to have that self, the whole idea of saving the world disappears. It's just more stupid karma. So we don't make any karma, no good karma, no bad karma. We sabbe sankhara samatha, we quell all will. And at the end of your life, if there's even a small blip of will arises at the end of your life, you will get reborn again. You have to be so still at the death, so nothing moves. Because nothing moves, nothing will be created. There will be no birth. That's how you end karma from the past. Sure, there's heaps and heaps of karma waiting for you. But because you don't own it, it's like the baggage. Sometimes people carry drugs from overseas, but they get smart and they leave the baggage on the carousel and they walk away. It doesn't belong to me, nothing to do with me, I don't own it. Same with the baggage of our past. We don't own it, so we leave it on the carousel and we never get reborn again. We leave it, we let it go. We're so still. At the end of our life, and nothing makes us move. How can you do that? The only way you can do that is you let go of the karma from the past. The karma from the past is what creates the movement of now. And if you carry that karma from the past, the karma creates this movement of now, which creates more karma for the future. It's a stillness. By letting go of the karma from the past, this is how we can stop karma happening. In the time of your death, you might be moving before, but the last few moments, please stop doing things. Please stop cravings. Please stop making things happen. Please stop aspiring for anything. Stop all aspirations. Completely be still. Don't even try and let go. That would be more controlling. Stillness. Just don't move. So nothing moves. The only way you can do that is to really let go of the sense of self, the one who does the moving. When that happens, no movement, no mover, then you don't create any more rebirth. This is why we practice now, to be still, to sit in our heart and do absolutely nothing. Sit down, close your eyes, do absolutely nothing. See how still you can be. Don't try and make meditation happen. See if you can try and stop this maker. not to try and attain jhanas, just to try and stop the attainer. This is actually where we look for the cause of these problems. Because all these jhanas are just deep states of letting go. They're just what happens when you're still. This is just things disappearing. These are stages of disappearance. You can't get to a next stage of disappearance when you're still doing something. You're still making things happen, you're still interfering, you're just creating more samsara rather than allowing samsara to disappear. So when you learn how to let go and be really still, let go of the karma from the past. Even actually sometimes when you're meditating, you know, sometimes I'm meditating, getting nowhere. Sometimes I think, oh, I'm just carrying the karma of getting nowhere. So I completely stop. Whatever's happened in the past, the last half an hour of hopeless meditation, I'm not going to allow that to control this next moment. I cut the karma of the first half an hour of my meditation. Completely cut it. And I can do that, which means the next moment is completely free. You just get this quantum leap in sort of meditation depth. You know how to let go of the karma of just half an hour of silly meditation. Cut it straight away. And it's not that hard to do. So you're not controlled by the past. You're not made of the past. You're not built of the past. You're not the heir to the past. This is how you stop that sort of saying, which applies to ordinary human beings, kama sakomhi, kama dayado, kama yoni, kama bandhu, kama patisarana. That applies to the non-Aryans, or the Aryans who forget. For the Aryans who don't forget, they know kama sakomhi, I'm not made of karma, I'm not made of anything, I'm gone. Kama dayado, I'm not the heir of anything, I've given up all inheritance, I don't own anything. Kama yoni, my womb has been destroyed. The seed has gone. Kama yoni. Kama bandhu. Bandhu means like you're bound by these things. Similar word. You're free of this. Kama patisarana. That you are abide. This is your refuge. No, you have no refuge. You're gone. Vanished. You're no longer a place where karma can take root. The alaya of karma. Alaya means the abiding, the resting, the roosting of karma is destroyed, the sense of self. You know the word alaya, I was explaining this to the Anagarika synopsis the other day, the Himalaya, the place where the snow rests. Hima, snow, alaya, resting place or abode of. The calm alaya, the resting place of karma, that's the sense of self, that's where the self, that's where karma rests. With no sense of self, karma's got no place to rest. I gave a simile a long time ago. I haven't said this a long time ago. It's like karma, it's like a bird. Good karma, bad karma, the black bird and the white bird. Just flying around trying to look for you so it can settle down and make a new life. But there's no place to settle down anymore. You have disappeared. So the black karma and the white karma, the two birds, they fly and fly and fly, looking for a place to settle, but they can't find one. They fly and fly until they're exhausted, and they fade away and die. That's the end of samsara. As long as karma has a place to settle on, there'll never be an end of samsara. You don't destroy the black bird, you don't destroy the white bird. As long as there's a sense of self, the black bird and the white bird will still be living, thriving. When the sense of self is finished, there's no place for the birds to roost. They get exhausted and die. That's how karma is transcended. And again, you can see it's all to do with the sense of self. And the sense of self is all to do with the doing. And the doing is all to do with not being able to meditate. All coming down to the same old thing again. Sit down. Shut up and don't do anything. Then you understand what karma is, and the end of karma, and what an arahat is all about. Sabba sankhara samatha. but all the sankharas, all the karmas, the black bird and the white bird, and the five khandhas, gone forever. Oh, what a relief. That's the talk about the ending of karma.
Sukhati Prabhu Bhagavato Sahaja.